My name is Eric. I work here at the Vineyard. I lead here at the Vineyard, sorry. David, you took all my introductory material away from me. It's really naughty. We are continuing our journey today through part of the biography of Jesus as recorded by Matthew, the first of four that you'll find at the beginning of the New Testament. Last week, Alex Griffin gave us a very good overview, I thought, of what these chapters contain. It's basically chapters 5, 6, and 7 in Matthew's Gospel. If you missed his talk or missed any of the others in the series, they are on the website under the tab Resources. So go there and you can listen to the podcasts from the various talks as well as talks that we've done throughout the year. The last passage that we are going to look at today, you will find in Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 47. There are Bibles on the tables around you, I think. Feel free to grab one, keep one if you don't have your own. The passage forms part of the collection of sayings that Jesus has used. And again, it is one of those passages that is incredibly famous and well known. So the challenge for us is going to be to strip away our familiarity with this and let it impact us again. So to connect with what is actually going on, what Jesus is saying. So, if you want to read with me, we'll start in verse 38. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go a mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the pagans do that. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. It always strikes me, how would you read this passage if ever you were to preach at a convention for tax lawyers and tax accountants? Whether they might take that personally. This section forms part of a whole series of sections that you'll find through chapter 5 and into chapter 6 that all start with the same beginning. It's always with Jesus says, you have heard it said that, the following, whatever it is. But I say that, something else, right? In the same way that he does here. And these sections sort of seem to pile one on top of the other. And I think that's quite a deliberate sort of piling up that Jesus does. On the one hand, as I said, I think, last time I stood up here, but I can't quite remember what I said last time. So, Jesus makes extensive use of hyperbole in these passages. He deliberately drives what he has to say to the furthest limit he can push it. So he ramps up these sort of rules for behavior to a level where nobody can really keep up. As an example, David Flowers pointed out 2 weeks ago that Jesus doesn't just say, don't kill anyone. He says, if you call your brother an idiot, you're already condemned. You know, you're already in danger of being condemned to hell. In this passage, we see the same thing. He says, don't just let someone hit him or hit you. You know, invite the person to hit you again by turning the other cheek. So, or don't just let someone sue you for your possessions. Give them the clothes off your back on top of whatever they're suing you for. So why does Jesus lay such a burden on his followers? And I think that's, unfortunately, how very often this gets preached. It's very easy, it's very tempting to preach this as a burden you lay off people, a set of rules that you have to obey or go to hell. But I don't think that that is what Jesus is trying to do. I think that what Jesus is trying to do is, on the one hand, he is deliberately ramping up the pressure on those people who think of themselves as holy and righteous people. So the kind of people who do very well on keeping God's commands and keeping them to the letter, and who are therefore quite certain of the fact that they are accepted by God. And that certainty that they are accepted then also allows them to feel quite proud of the fact that they are this good at obeying the rules, and that they are just a little bit better than everyone else who doesn't quite cut it in the same way they do. So why does Jesus pressurize these people? I think he's trying to make holy people realize that holiness is about more than keeping to the rules. It's, on the one hand, he's trying to make clear that it is impossible for us to keep these rules in the way we would need to if we were going to measure up under our own steam. So he points out that God doesn't just want us to love our friends, which is hard enough already. He says, you also need to love your enemies, you know. He doesn't just want us to avoid injuring somebody. He wants us to avoid getting angry. And that is one of the reasons, I think, that Jesus tends to be so angry when he speaks to the Pharisees. He's not angry that the Pharisees want to be holy. He is not angry that they aren't as holy as they should be. What he's angry about is that the Pharisees should be the one people who know that they can't be as holy as they should be. They spend so much time studying the law that they should be the ones who know that a human being can't keep up with this, can't keep the standard. On the other hand, I think Jesus is desperate for holy people to realize that holiness isn't about the perfect keeping of rules in the first place. It never was that. It was never intended to be that. Holiness is about the quality of our relationships, quality of our relationship to God, and the quality of our relationships to the people around us. Right? After all, Jesus points out that the summary of the law is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and all your strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. That is what defines holiness. Holiness is about love. It is about keeping in step with our Creator. Again, David Flowers talked about that in part 2 weeks ago when he spoke about the cosmic nature of relationship. And what is the basis of our relationship to our Creator? It isn't our keeping of rules, and it is not even our love for Him. It is His grace for us. That's what it is bound. Everything is built on. It is His grace personified in and lived out by Jesus Christ. And it is His grace that keeps on seeking us out and that brings us back into right relationship with our God and Creator, even when we turn away. And it's that grace that keeps on seeking us and keeps on looking for us. And then, just as an aside on the rule thing, it's worth pointing out that the rules Jesus talks about are actually quite incomplete. They are rather short, if you think about it. There's nothing in the Sermon on the Mount on international banking. There's nothing about democratic governance. There's nothing about council tax. There's nothing about property law. All of which are things that would be very handy to know about if you're going to run the country. Nor, for that matter, is any of that in the rules, in the law in the Old Testament, the books of the Old Testament known as the Pentateuch, which contained the law that the people of Israel were meant to keep. Those rules don't contain any of that either. It's, as a number of theologians have pointed out, it's one of the shortest collections of laws in the history of humanity, basically, because it is not about the rules, it's about the relationship. And the problem this has created is that the church has very often been silent on issues that aren't overtly in the Bible. So we have, fortunately now, some Christians who begin to talk about our responsibility to the environment. We have some Christian groups that are starting to talk about or protest against the international slave trade that is still going on today. But it still the church is often and has often been far too silent on issues of abuse of power and exploitation of the poor, because it doesn't necessarily say that in the Sermon on the Mount. So they have made, in that sense, very often the same mistake as the Pharisees did. The mistake to try to turn what Jesus talks about here in the Sermon on the Mount into a set of rules that we obey, and as long as we stick to these ones, we are okay. We don't have to worry about any of the other stuff. And Jesus wasn't really interested in defining a list for us of do's and don'ts for a good life. What he was interested in is to call us back into relationship, which is only possible through God's grace. So, with this focus in mind, let's approach then enemies and teeth. I think that in part was what, essentially, if we want to condense what Jesus is trying to say in this passage about teeth and enemies, is that we, as people who are beloved and rescued by our Creator, we do not have the option to think of others as our enemies. Even if, or particularly when, the other treats us as their enemy. One way to understand what Jesus means is to think back about the particular audience that Jesus is addressing when he talks about enmity, so this process of turning someone else into an enemy. Jesus is speaking to the people of Israel, who have a very clear sense of who they are and where they fit in the world. Right? They are, after all, the people who are beloved by the Almighty Creator of the entire universe. They are his very special chosen people. And that Almighty God has rescued them. He has brought them first through their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has rescued them out of Egypt. They know that they have lost their special status for a little while because of what their forefathers did. But they believe firmly that their God will return. And he will rescue them. And he will defeat their enemies, all of them, and cast them out into darkness and death. And he will then set up the people of Israel as the rightful rulers of the whole world. That is how they know themselves. So they have a very clear idea of who their enemy is. It's quite self-evident. First of all, it's the pagans and the Roman occupiers first amongst them, because they will be destroyed by God. God has said so. They know. On the other hand, it is all those people within the people of Israel who can't keep the law and who mess things up because they keep on messing up the law, and therefore they keep on making God angry, and so God keeps on delaying the time when he will return. Right? So that's very obvious who the enemy is. They have biblical proof for the fact that those people are in fact the enemy. There's also a reason why Jesus uses the example of being sued and of being forced to work for someone as the examples. He's addressing a group of peasants who routinely were getting sued by rich people and would routinely lose the lawsuit because they didn't have the same amount of money. They were also the people who would routinely be press-ganged, particularly by the Roman occupiers, to work as laborers or as carriers of gear and equipment and all that sort of stuff. So they had not just a good theological reason for hating their enemy, they had a very good practical reason for hating their enemy as well, because they kept on interfering with their lives and kept on messing their lives up. Yet it is to these people that Jesus says, love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you. The person you think of as your enemy isn't your enemy at all. So how does that work for us? How does that apply? Who are our enemies? Now, you might, like me, think that you don't really have enemies. I mean, I don't have enemies. I'm a very nice guy. I'm very friendly sometimes, except when I'm scary and South African and German. But for the most part, I'm very friendly. I don't have enemies, right? Nobody really hates me. But maybe that's just because of how I define what an enemy is. So let's think about what an enemy might be. The problem with an enemy comes in when there's conflict, right? People can become our enemies, or there's the potential for them to become enemies when there is conflict, when there's a clash of values, of interests, of viewpoints. But that doesn't mean that every person we have a conflict with also turns into an enemy. There needs to be something extra. I think the extra bit is, someone becomes an enemy when I stop to think of them and treat them as worthy of being treated with dignity, with respect, and with love. So when I withdraw from the other person my permission to be who they are, to be treated with dignity, instead they become the person I have to fight and to defeat. And usually it's the other person's fault. It's they who started it. As a small example, my eldest son has just started going to school, so we have now, my wife and I have now encountered the problem of training days, right? Everybody who's a parent with kids in school knows about training days, right? That's when, in the middle of the year, at some terribly awful time, that's totally in the middle of your most stressed time ever, the teachers all decide to bog off somewhere. Apparently, they do something really useful. Before any of the teachers kill me, I see Pete staring at me. So they go off and they get trained and they get better at teaching, but they leave you with a kid to sort out that you don't really have any plans for because you weren't really intending to be doing kids' work at that time, right? Or to look after your child. So the first time this happened to us, we needed to have a conversation about who needs to take time off work in order to look after our son who now suddenly is at home instead of being at school where he should be. And before I knew it, I turned our discussion about, you know, times and schedules and who goes where when into a fight about who has more pressure at work and who has sacrificed more for this family. Because I had sacrificed lots more and I had way more pressure and I was going to win this one. And I had to take a step back. Fortunately, at some point in the middle of all this discussion going on, it's probably because Yannick at some point started shouting at the two of us. He does that. When he fights much, he gets engaged and he starts fighting as well. Usually it's something like, "You took my glass away!" or something. Anyway, so I had to take a step back and go, hang on a second. At what point did Birgit turn into my enemy? Right? Why is she suddenly the person I have to fight and defeat? And surprisingly, once we'd sort of calmed down, it was actually quite easy to find a solution. I took my son with me to the office and sat him in front of a DVD of Cars and then a DVD of The Chronicles of Narnia, and he was perfectly happy for 3 hours, and I did my work. It wasn't really a big deal. And it's quite heart-wrenching, isn't it, how the people that we love the most also tend to end up the people we fight hardest. But that's not really all. Jesus says, love your enemy. Turn the other cheek. Why does he insist on that? Why doesn't he just say, oh, just tolerate the people who annoy you? And if you happen to be in a fight, try to be as reasonable as you can be for as long as you can. The simple answer is that is just not enough. It is not enough to hold back our enmity for as long as the other person doesn't annoy us too much. It is not enough to try to be polite until you get to the end of your tether and then you blow up. That's just setting down some rules for other people to obey if they want to remain your friends. That's not loving your enemy. Because the problem is that once we have set down some rules to keep, that other people need to keep, we are already preparing the ground for what we'll do about the fact that they will break the rule that we just set. I love movie westerns. I might be alone in that love in this room. They appeal to the kid in me. And it's just cool to watch stuff blow up in slow motion. There's just something about that that's totally thrilling. But they actually expressed this this sort of dynamic of conditional friendship in a very good way. You remember in the classic Western, you always have a bad guy. He is identified by the fact that he wears some sleazy, ugly clothes, very unfashionable, and he looks angry all the time. And he threatens a few people, and he might even shoot one or two of them. Then there is the good guy. He also very often wears something unfashionable and sleazy and looks really angry all the time. But he doesn't really threaten that many people, or he only threatens those people that we already know are evil. And so he doesn't really shoot people all that much. Until, that is, the bad guy does something really bad. He threatens the girl, or he wants to blow up the town, or something else equally dastardly, right? And then the good guy realizes he has no other option but to start fighting. And boy, does he start fighting, right? He starts laying waste in a way you have not seen before. The bad guy might have, you know, deluded himself into thinking that he is quite good at killing people, but he's not a patch on the good guy. Right? The good guy, every bullet hits, every last shot kills someone, you know, through the head. He's worse than the plague and death in person combined. And the film always ends with the bad guy dying a particularly gruesome death, because that's more satisfying. And that is actually really a very good illustration of what we often do, what I often do, in the circumstances where others might become my enemies. So in the circumstances when they, deliberately or not, act in a way that brings them into conflict with me. So we might try to show some forbearance at first. We might come up with some, you know, try to understand why they might act in the way that they do. So, you know, they might have had a bad curry the night before, or they are unhappy in some form, or they have some pressure at work, or something like that. But the longer they persist in their conflict with us, the angrier we get. And soon we stop trying to understand, and we start to remember all the other times that that person was really, really annoying. Or when we met someone just like them who was really, really annoying. Or we just had a conversation that was almost like the conversation we're having at the moment. And we start to hit back. We lash out with everything we've got, whether it's in action or in words or whatever. Because the other person just doesn't leave us any choice. We have to fight. And what often emerges only after we've already had a fight is that we stop to respect and to love the other person. We stop to treat them with dignity. And very often the root cause of that refusal to treat others with respect is actually the root cause of the conflict in the first place. And that is why Jesus has to insist, love your enemies. We cannot allow ourselves even to think about enmity, turning someone else into our enemy, the person we have to fight. Not even as a last resort. Not even when we feel thoroughly justified to do so. Because as soon as we allow the possibility to enter our heads that this might be a situation of fighting, it gathers pace. And it gathers momentum, and it grows until we find ourselves in the middle of a fight that we didn't really know how it started in the first place. Of course, as with all the other things that Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, as I said at the beginning, the very point that Jesus is trying to make is that we can't do this on our own. To love our enemies isn't another command that we have to keep and we have to work at keeping. Instead, it is a challenge and it is an encouragement for us to keep on seeking God's grace. So when next we find ourselves treating someone else as our enemy, that's the point when we turn to Jesus and we say to him, I can't do this on my own. I can't love people that I find unlovely. I can't love on my own in circumstances where the other person just really is annoying and I have want to throttle them. I need God's grace. And Jesus' promise is that he will give us grace. We've got 5 minutes, so let me approach this from a slightly different angle, which makes the whole idea of enmity very problematic. You may have been listening to this and you might have thought, that's all well and good, but what about the circumstance where genuine evil doing is at stake? What do we do if the other person genuinely is an evil person? And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to that, I just have an illustration. Most of you will know that I was born and raised in South Africa. I was raised under the apartheid regime, so the reservation of 80% of the country's resources and land for the use of 5% of the population who happened to be white. Someone called that one of the most evil regimes in the history of humanity. That regime was resisted most forcibly by the African National Congress, who in the early 1960s decided that violence was their only option. It was the only option left to them because the government wouldn't listen to peaceful protest. And that violence led to thousands and thousands of deaths, most of them innocent black people caught in the middle. But it didn't topple the regime. It didn't change anything. What toppled the regime was the determination of one man, Nelson Mandela, not to see an enemy in the Afrikaner jailers and politicians and policemen that he encountered. He was determined not to see them as anything, as enemies, but as friends he hadn't yet made. And that changed everything. That's where that's where it all began. And the other examples are the same thing. There's the Velvet Revolution over in Poland. There's the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. There's any number of places where peaceful protest destroyed regimes that had resisted violence forever. Now, we need to remember that loving our enemies will not be easy. If you turn the other cheek, you do ask the other person to hit you twice. And chances are they will. But it does provide the chance for something different to happen, something new to enter the world that isn't blow and counterblow. Would you like to start? I think I'll pray and then hand over to David. And so, may God bless us with his love for enemies. The kind of love that caused him to become a part of the humanity that hated him. And to lay down his life that those who hated him might not be destroyed, but might be able to come into right relationship with him again. And as you seek to love your enemies, may you too experience how God's grace and mercy transforms your relationships, even the ones that seem beyond rescue, and allows a garden of love to grow where there's only been a wasteland of hate. Amen.